There was Marie Callas from Greece, the country of Greece, and she was married to, I forgot his name, the billionaire person who Jackie Onassis married afterwards. Can't remember his name at the moment, but she's a beautiful singer. So I hope when you hear, I try to select the best, purest music I can find. So the only thing I would suggest is that you allow this music into the deepest level of consciousness that you can expose to this music, because it has a healing quality, and that's what we want here. We're trying to trying to instigate some healing and the expansion of consciousness. And okay, now next we're going to have Eckhart Tolle, one of the modern teachers of mankind. He's written many books. One is called, his first book is called The Power of Now. He's an excellent teacher. And I played this piece before on this show, but it's such a basic piece, I just feel like playing it again. And the title of it is To Think or Not to Think. And the full range of life ranges from the chaotic field of thought and forms. Form is any form that you look on in the outside world. Trees, lakes, rivers, houses, everything, people, whatever. But it also encompasses form and feel, thought and feeling, and all the other stuff that goes on in your mind. That's also part of the outer world of form. And the mind usually likes to be involved in this outer chaos and outer aspect, not always chaos, but outer aspect of life. And it enjoys the ups and downs, the pains and the pleasures. However, there is another part of life that can get obscure if the intensity of the outer forms is heavy. You can the other part, the silent part, the formless part, the part that is the source of your beingness, can get obscured. And this part is actually in itself, it's peace, love, harmony, and joy and bliss. And so if it gets obscured under a lot of stress and negativity, and I don't know if you notice, but when a person is stressed, they more thoughts come in their mind. Like the Italians, when they get up stressed, they start repeating words, 10 to a second. So it's also true in my experience as a medical doctor that when a person accumulates a lot of stress in their body, they also tend to talk more. So they lose that basic stability, that basic silence, that basic inner connection. And so that's what the whole field of spirituality is about. It's about reintegrating that other aspect, the formless aspect, the real self, into our awareness. Besides the outer content of life, we have 100% of the outer and 100% of the inner. Without the 100% of the inner, life becomes quite shallow and superficial. And also in that outer 100% is the personality, the person, and the persona and the ego are involved. And that is the suffering self. Once the me is involved, the person becomes personal, and suffering starts there. With the other self, the universal self, which transcends the ego and personality and person, that one has very little suffering, if any, maybe some toothache once in a while. But no psychological component to that, no suffering in that sense. All right, so we're going to hear Eckhart Tolle now.
We as human beings are at a transitional stage where we are we're becoming strongly aware of the pull back to the source. So there are two movements in the universe. One is out into more and more form, and more thinking is still there, that movement. There are still many people who believe that the problems of this world can be solved if we just think harder about them. Have more committee meetings about the problems of the world and discuss them, and eventually they can be solved. They don't realize that the problems of the world are there because we have lost touch with the source out of which everything came. So by going into further differentiation, we cannot solve the problems, we'll actually increase them. So we need to balance now, return to the source, and going out into the world. It doesn't mean we don't do anything anymore. We can still create and do, but not lose ourselves in creating and doing and thinking. Lose ourselves in the mind, connected with the timeless, formless source of all life within space of no thought. Connected with that, then we can create, not we as persons, but we as a universal movement of consciousness. Consciousness wants us to be co-creators of the universe, of form. So we can be that, but only if we are connected. We need conscious connection with the source. So that's the destiny, that's your life purpose, that's why we're here. And if it sounds
And more about destiny and life purpose in the next show of Dr. Mike, which is coming up on Monday and Tuesday. Mike is in the studio, and who knows, he may make some medical comments or some... who knows what kind of comments he's going to make during the show. That's Dr. Michael, who will be with you live on the air, as apparently, I'm not sure if he was live today or not, but his show airs every Monday from 6 to 8. Thank you, from 6 to 8, and then on Tuesday from 8 to 9. Hey, do I hear an echo in the studio? Excellent. Anyway, stay tuned for Bathrobe Spears Broadsides coming up. We're the stream, we're not the broadcast, but we are worth listening to. I think at least there's some voices that you probably haven't heard before, though you may have heard folks like them. So stay tuned.
The whole problem for only one reason. That president raises the question, who owns the land? The homeless, our problem. For only one reason, our president raises the question, who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Could it be 90 million dead Indians? Who owns the land? Could it be 6 million Jews? Who owns the land? Is there a process raises a question to all the land. Ecocide, genocide, where is hope? Ecocide, genocide, where is hope? Ecocide, genocide, where is hope? Ecocide, genocide, where is home?
And that again was the ever-present voice of Five, which sang Land. You are tuned to the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz at freakradio.org, as usual. We've been busy ignoring our antenna situation, and hopefully folks out there are beginning to think about it, because we ain't got no antenna yet, and we need one. That should be something that those of us at the studio, particularly me, are supposed to be involved with. But I really appreciate it if folks can call in with any kind of advice about where we might locate an antenna for free radio. That, I know, is a familiar refrain, but it's a need we have. So give a call off-air to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. If you have any ideas about or want to help search for an antenna site for Free Radio Santa Cruz, because we're overdue to that, for that, and every day we don't have one is not only a day that you don't get to hear us on the radio, but it's a day that our broadcasters may choose to stay at home and get a good night's rest or a good day's sleep or something to that effect. So, that's the commercial announcement, or the non-commercial announcement, the necessary announcement to continue what we're doing. And just to remind you, if you want to be a part of Free Radio, if you want to have be on the stream and hopefully on the air soon, you can become a part of the collective. You got to pay dues and help defray the rent. You are encouraged to come to meetings, but I sometimes do and sometimes don't. But it's a sort of an attempt to create a more open voice in the community, as your regular listeners know. So get in touch on freakradio.org. There's I think we have an updated schedule there now. I always say we've got a schedule there, but I think we've got somebody working on that, and I haven't checked it lately, but there's something on the wall, and that's a good sign. So, anyway, hey, welcome to Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. This is a show that concerns itself with local stuff. I'm particularly active in denouncing the city's behavior toward poor and homeless people, its lack of transparency in different government functions, how the police department treats people, often mistreats people, but occasionally I've got to put in a good word for them as well. And I think last time I was running through some of the People's Park speeches and interviews, that's up in Berkeley. That's an event that happened last Saturday, where folks up there are facing similar problems to poor people down here. There is a gentrification process happening. Merchants and conservative residents have acquired unbalanced power. That's what usually happens with wealth, almost inevitably, until there's some kind of broader reaction from the lower community, or until things fall apart, because wealth actually kind of destroys itself. I mean, you have an entire community involved. As long as they obey the slave-servant-master paradigm, you're okay, but when they decide, or when they can no longer obey it, because they simply can't make enough at the starvation wages to buy what they need to pay for their families or lodge their families or pay for medical care, then it, even if people don't revolt, the whole thing falls apart. It's a kind of grand illusion. While everybody is there together, you can you know, continue to exploit people, but in the end, it don't work. At least that is my kind of analysis of the moment. I don't consider myself a deep or profound thinker on the subject, but what you see in front of you is sometimes what you get, and then you extrapolate from what you see. I had promised readers of Santa Cruz Indie Media, Indie Bay, that the protest that we did yesterday, we would actually play tape on today. Unfortunately, I am unable to find the tape.
I'm still looking for it. I may actually be able to do it before the end of the show, hopefully before Sunday. But I'm going to have to kind of brief you verbally and also encourage you to read the article on Santa Cruz Indie Media. We have a persistent caller, and I always like persistent callers. Hey there, caller. Welcome to Free Radio.
Oh, hey. So you don't need to put me on the air, although I don't care if you do.
Well, unfortunately, you are on the air, so watch your tongue there, caller.
Oh, is this Robert?
Of course. Who else would it be?
Huh. Oh, okay. Well, because I didn't hear your voice earlier.
Really?
I'm just calling because I miss Free Radio on the air and don't really listen to it streaming. And just wanted to give you guys the message that if I'm out there missing you, then there's probably other people too. So I know that as DJs, you probably don't know how many people are listening. So count me as one that is wishing that I could listen to you in my car. So
yeah, well, that's really great, caller. I know. Have you been? Were you listening by chance to us on the stream a moment ago, or did you just sort of?
Yeah, I was just talking to David and saying, you know, I should really call them and let them know how much I miss them on the air because there's probably a lot of us out there, and you know, you just don't know how many people are listening. And I should call, and he handed me the phone. No, here I am. But
yeah, well, that's. Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, you know, I guess what we need is people to keep their eyes open for, you know, a tall tree on a friendly piece of property where there's a power source. It doesn't take a lot of power to you know, power our transmitter, but it does take a location. And we are, maybe our eyes are tired here at Free Radio.
I guess my worry is that maybe if people are getting burnt out and tired of looking and maybe don't know how many of us are out there that are actually really enjoying listening to the actual radio and don't really have it together streaming. So, you know, that was just my thought is that you might think that, well, everybody's listening to it streaming anyway, and there's few of us out there who don't.
Yeah, I mean, more than that, as I said before, I think not only does it impact listeners, it impacts broadcasters. Broadcasters are less likely to come in, less likely to join up if they feel they're just going out on some internet stream because, you know, people can do their own podcasts and do. I'm glad they do, actually. But, you know, Free Radio is a place where people kind of, if not like mind, at least sort of in a coalition of minds, can come together and share.
Well, not only that,
criticize.
You have a lot of alternative news and alternative state. I think it's the best station. It really, there's not really anything else out there. KZSC plays some good music. A few of the other stations on the dial have different pop stuff happening, but nothing comes close to what Free Radio has been doing, in my opinion.
We are the greatest. I mean, let's face it.
So I'm missing you guys. That's it.
Well, thank you, caller, and keep calling in. And next time, call in with an antenna location, and we will give you a special bonus.
No kidding. Well, yeah, so whoever's listening that has a nice, friendly, tall tree or some property that that the antenna can go up, and they should call in next, right?
They should indeed.
They should indeed. All right. Take care.
Thank you, caller. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I recognize that voice, a friend of Free Radio for some years. And a lot of people are, I'm surprised, even in different parts of the world, long-term listeners. It's amazing. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to dragoon Dr. Mike here to actually meet tomorrow or the next day, to actually spend some time figuring out what to do, looking for antenna sites. I mean, we have not really systematically approach this, or at least I haven't, and I kind of encourage people on the our own Free Radio internal email to get together and do something, look for stuff, kick me around till I do something, and it's so far, you know, I haven't gotten any results, but this is only the beginning. Hopefully it's not the end. So, just to begin with, I'm going to do a kind of an update, which I really did in print last night. I spent about 2 or 3 hours putting together a story. It didn't seem like it would take that long, but it took a while. for the protest that we did on Cop Corner, as may now be called. That's Laurel and Center Streets, where the Santa Cruz Police Department has its $12 million headquarters. It actually was supposed to be $5 million, but they had a $7 million cost overrun. You know, the shooting range and the basement and all that sort of thing. And in spite of all that, if you want to reclaim your property from a police officer who has taken it from you at night because you were trying to sleep and he said, no, no, that violates the sleeping ban or you're in a forbidden zone, you have to go back only, you have only 4 hours a week when you can reclaim your property, 12:30 to 2:30 on Tuesdays and Thursdays. $7 million plus $5 million for 4 hours a week for poor people. Great. All right, well, we have a caller again. Yo, caller, you're welcome to Free Radio.
Yeah, I had some news about where the transmitter, the antenna is going
to
be.
Oh, you do? You mean you want to announce it publicly so the FCC can come and help us put it up?
I'll just tell you. You can decide.
We are on the air. You should be aware.
At the last meeting, we were discussing placing it temporarily at the old location where it was, and there wasn't enough help to get it up by this Sunday, but it should be up in 2 weeks.
Well, that's great news, because I have not noticed any calls for help on the email, but if anybody wants me to help...
There's nobody like good old Dennis, and he won't be here.
Yeah, we as for all you folks listening, we need techies at the to join the collective. Young blood to assist the older blood, which is pretty important, too. But, yeah, so that's good news there, caller. And also, broadcaster, you want to give a plug for your own show there, broadcaster?
Well, I dragged myself in and did my show today, but I noticed that very minimally few were listening to the talk.
Yeah.
So, I'm listening now, though.
That's my concern, that it's not so much going to decimate the listening population, which is perhaps more important, but what we will begin to notice is that broadcasters themselves will think they got, you know, better things to do with their time than talk to five people on the air, or on the stream, I should say, because people aren't on the air. But I'm glad to hear that we are at least intent on moving forward. Do we have a commitment from people who can put up the antenna that it will be done?
You
let me know when that's going to happen, and I will attempt to be there, and I guess... Dr. Mike is signaling me that he will be of assistance in advising me of that, too. So, thank you very much. Any other reports from the street there, caller? I know.
Not today.
Okay. Hey. All right. Well, thank you, and thank you for doing your show, anyway, in spite of all the diminishing possible returns.
Yeah.
What? Sorry.
10-4.
Bye-bye. So that's, we got at least one listener, and then another person who, even though not a listener, called in. And it looks like we're on a, on a roll. This is better than when we're on the air. Maybe we should go off the air, more like, more recent, more, yeah. Hey there, caller. Welcome to Free Radio.
Well, thank you. I got a little confused at which number to dial, but I appreciate you listening to me. I feel, you know, like a real special elite. When I think of all the people out there that can't get what I'm streaming, you know, streaming on here and can't get out there and broadcasting, I like to encourage all the listeners that you have that are streaming to think of those out there that are no longer receiving this information because of no broadcast capability. We've got to have an antenna. Come on, people, let's divvy up. It's time to pay the piper.
It's true, and if you get any ideas yourself while strolling about, caller, you let me know.
Well, you know, all I like to do anymore is dance. So maybe I could throw some kind of dance demonstration and charge people money for it.
Or just dance your way down the block and keep your eyes open as you do your two-step.
Yeah, I could dance with a Free Radio Santa Cruz label on a can and get money for it.
Sure, or just, you know, keep your eyes open for that antenna side because that's really...
Okay, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
money's
that's
good, too.
That's one thing I can do because, you know, I walk, you know, that's my... Besides... talking mushroom and blue-green algae, walking is what kept me alive 39 years with HIV.
Well,
so walking is my health, and so I see a lot of neighbors. I'm going to make a very special point of that, Robert. I will.
Hey, stay alive for another 39 years, please.
Okay, dokie, okay. Well, in my family, that is the way it goes.
No, that's good. All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
Later. Bye-bye. Calling number is open for all of you callers who are just wanting to break into free radio here. 427-3772, 427-FRSC. We are Free Radio Santa Cruz on the stream at freakradio.org. I again apologize to folks who are calling in about, or not calling in, listening in, want to know what happened at the protest. Of course, my suggestion is come on down to the next one, which we may well do next Wednesday or whenever we get a mind to do it. We're going to try to announce it, I hope, a little bit more in advance. But it's really not that hard or even necessary to have an announcement weeks and weeks in advance. I mean, you can, if you want to get out there today and raise up an issue that is important, as we did, our issue was racial profiling by the Santa Cruz Police Department and also homeless profiling, more important actually, in terms of my focus as a honky, and also, but I'm a community member too, is that people who are poor are getting routinely, systematically, and abusively hassled in an almost impersonal manner by the system that we live under here in Santa Cruz. And the police department, you might say, is the innocent, or it didn't make the policy, it's just their job, hand of it, but they're the people who do it, largely. And, you know, am I suggesting police officers revolt and give up their job and watch their children go shoeless and their babies starve? No, not necessarily. But I think one has to speak up when individuals, particularly with guns, badges, tasers, batons, beanbag guns, military equipment, license identifiers, and attitudes are making a lot of us feel very uncomfortable, even those of us who they're not directly attacking, but those of us who have to watch this shit go down. And so what happened yesterday, again, if you want to get my account, you can go to Santa Cruz Indie Media. That's at indiebay.org. And I wrote a story there, which I'm looking up at now, called Report from SCPD Corner. And it's actually our corner, but it's the corner on which I would say probably the most traffic passes by foot of the two corners that face the street of the Santa Cruz Police Department. And the issue, as I brought up these issues on the air in the past 2 months, has not only been that of Yanides Brown, her report, which you can read on Santa Cruz Indie Media, of Officer Barnett giving a false smoking ticket, in her estimation, to was either her fiancé or her brother. The two of them were together. They're all African-American. Two of them got hauled away to jail. There was a massive police response. I haven't heard anything from Yanides since then, and I hope that she has been able to successfully address these issues. I think her brother's or whoever got the resisting arrest or obstructing an officer ticket, which is a standard kind of filler for we don't know what to do, but we called out the cops and we came in numbers and you complained, so we got to figure out some kind of charge. So we'll put that one down. And I'm very serious. That's been my experience on a number of occasions with people, both that I've seen, visually seen, but also mostly that I've gotten reports from that I regard as credible on this show. The point that we had yesterday was to look at the racial classifications of the citations of one particular officer, Officer Bradley Barnett, who is a CSO, a community service officer, goes around downtown harassing people, at least according to the numerous accounts that I've gotten on the air. And I've got to be frank, my personal relationship with Bradley is not the best. I've never been ticketed by him. I've never been personally harassed by him. I've been given attitude, like I won't talk to you, why should I bother to talk to you kind of attitude from him. But nothing that has been directly abusive. I don't expect police officers to like me. I mean, I'm a critic of the police department, so what do you expect? In fact, yesterday at the demonstration, as I mentioned in this account, I think one officer reportedly gave us the finger. and a member of the protest felt this was inappropriate for a police officer to do, and she went in and she made a complaint at the police department, which wasn't too far away. It was, you know, about 100 steps away. But, you know, my response to this was, well, at least he's honest. He's not giving you a smile while snarling behind the smile. And I appreciate candor in a way. The problem with candor, of course, from people in positions of authority is they have power, unnecessary and intimidating power that goes behind the normal kinds of First Amendment expressions that somebody would say, fuck you, man, if you get angry with someone on the streets, if you're outspoken and you speak in that way. It's like if you do that and you're in uniform and you have the authority, the community behind you, and the power to kill the person that you're criticizing without much consequence, you know, other than a possible administrative suspension with pay, which is what the usual thing is with police officers who shoot people dead in this country get, then it's a little different than free speech from a person who is not in uniform and not on duty. So there's that to consider. I found it was quite an effective protest, even though we had relatively small numbers. There were like a half a dozen of us there. Our plan involved, you know, evolved over a few days before. And the issue again was Officer Barnett. Has he been? I'm pretty convinced that Barnett is a harasser of people on the streets under the downtown ordinances. Now, the downtown ordinances, you know, can't sit near a building, can't sit near a bench, can't sit on essentially 99% of the sidewalk. And that's not really an exaggeration. If you consider the whole sidewalk and you look at what's left for people to actually sit down on, if they want to sit down on the sidewalk, it is a fraction and it is hard to find. And it is similarly hard to find a place where you can set up a table if you want a leaflet or a sit down a cap or a guitar case if you want to play for donation, or if you want to vend and you're a street artist. Now you might say, well, wait a minute, all this stuff up and down the avenue, I see people there all the time. Yeah, what are you talking about? And the answer is they're all illegal, but they're not harassed because it is simply now at the discretion of the police whether to harass. And there's some who believe that a community that does this is fine. You know, leave it to the cops to decide who are the troublemakers, and they will, you know, exercise good judgment and deal with people, and then enforce the laws and say, "Well, see, you got a law, you're illegal. These other five people are also illegal, but they're acting nicer, so you're the one that has to move along. You're the one who gets the $200 and $300 citation. You're the one who gets treated like a criminal." And that's not what we're supposed to have in our society. That's the kind of mechanism that a society of fear has, a society under siege, a society that believes it's about to be threatened. And that is really the perception that a certain group of people who are really now in power or strongly supporting those in power in Santa Cruz have been able to pump into the public mind and into the public venues. Usually by shaking cans of needles, screaming about meth freaks, ranting about the shooting of the two officers, Butler and Baker, that happened two years ago, nearly now. Raising the dire spectacle of children being at risk because they're homeless people sleeping in Santa Cruz because they don't have any place to sleep. This is toxic nonsense. This is the kind of bigotry that ultimately results in the kind of mass murder it can result in countries where war breaks out between these groups of people. You've seen this, for example, in Yugoslavia. You see it in Iraq. And it's also happening in Syria to some extent, where one group of people, not so much because they have different religious views, but because one of them has power over the other, mainly because Western powers in these particular countries have imposed their way and supported a particular class or religious group to be in power as their agents, as they did, for example, with Saddam Hussein in Yeah, they did. They supported Saddam Hussein. People say, what do you mean? We went to war. We killed Saddam Hussein. We executed. We gave him to the Iraqi puppet government there to execute. You know, no, that's true. But we funded Saddam Hussein in his war with Iran back in the 80s. And we were supporters of him, even though, you know, we didn't like some of the stuff. We being the government, sorry, the U.S. government did that. Anyway, this is a long rant. One thing that you also may find of interest on this website and on this in this article, report from SCPD Corner. Maybe I should just read the article. I think it's not that long, so I think I probably will. But the one thing that I'm not going to read is these citations of Bradley Barnett are online now on this article. You can read every ticket that he wrote, according to the police department. What is missing from these tickets is the race of the person that he gave the ticket to. And this is particularly interesting to me, not because I have seen a lot of racism myself by the police. Partially, you know, I'm insensitive to this because I'm white. I don't notice it that much when it happens. It doesn't affect me and my white, largely white friends. But because as a broadcaster, I've received reports and seen different kinds of stories on IndieBay, that whether it's Ms. Brown's story that I talked about earlier, whether it's Pat and John Colby videotaping Officer Azua, apparently singling out African Americans for smoking tickets and then harassment. Whether it's whatever the incident is, and those are the two that come to mind most recently. It seemed to me it would be appropriate to see if there's, you know, does there seem to be a pattern? Because certainly blacks make up a disproportionate number of folks in jail. It kind of jail is the new slave plantation for, you know, African Americans, and it's an issue. Is it an issue in Santa Cruz that people need to be activated around? I've had the sensation that, yeah, it probably is. Santa Cruz is not isolated from the rest of this country. This is also a class issue, too. So that's why we wanted to find out what the racial classifications are. And so far, they've declined to give it to us in a usable form. They're insisting we come in and look at the tickets. And we wanted to come in yesterday, but they suddenly told us, no, you have to want to give us a week to prepare the tickets. Well, Jackie Dressler, who's the Santa Cruz Records person, has been in the past, although not always as helpful as I'd like, but she eventually has come through with records that I've requested, and I appreciate her doing that. So yesterday all we did was we simply held up signs, served coffee and brownies, shouted out to passing cars our concerns about over-policing, particularly of homeless people, not to mention people of color. A lot of people of color, Latino folks, African-American folks, I don't know, Native American folks, folks from different nationalities that I am unaccustomed to referring to, but darker of skin hue, shouted out or nodded solidarity. I was rather surprised. So I'm going to try to play some of this stuff next time. Again, my apologies for not having more this time. And I will turn right now to a little musical break. I can get my bearings. We can go ahead, and I will play some other stuff. I think I'll play for the rest of the People's Park interviews and discussions, which I think are quite interesting. And there will be follow-ups. People's Park and the city of Berkeley is now doing, I think, the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement, which blossomed in 1964, fighting the University of California. Of course, they're trying to turn it into an iconic, everything is wonderful. I'm glad these students showed us the right way, and now we're all happy and gay, and the First Amendment reigns supreme, which isn't true at all. But it also is still an occasion for people to get together and raise issues that are currently abusive against tenants, against workers, against homeless people. against low-income folks, against minorities, against disabled people. Anyway, let's hear a little musica, and I will be right back.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British War. Young land started growing, young blood started flowing. I'm marching anymore, for I've killed my share of Indians in a thousand different fights. I was there at the Little Bighorn. I heard many men saw many more dying, but I'm marching anymore. Well, it's always the old lead us to the war. It's always the young to fall. Now look at all we've done with the saber and the gun. From Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. I even killed my brother, so many others. But I ain't marching anymore, for I marched to the battles of the German trench in war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men. Now they want me back again. I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old that lead us to the war. It's always the poor who die. Now look how far we've come with the saber and the gun. Tell me, was it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese sky. I set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. 'Cause I saw to the hearts of the president's men, I saw money piled like bodies on the floor. I saw tears traded for diamonds, fears made for the buying.
Sundown's finished and midnight's broken toll. We ducked inside the doorway, thunder crashing. As majestic bells of bolts struck shadows in the sound, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing. Flashing and for each and every other.
was two from Jefferson Starship, Ain't Marching Anymore, Phil Oakes' song, and Chimes of Freedom. So, you're still tuned to the stream of free radio, freakradio.org. We're still missing an antenna site, so go out there and find one for us or get us to do it. I'm Robert Norris. This is Bathrobes, Pierre's Broadsides. These shows are archived on the Huff website. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and it can be found at huffsantacruz.org. We also have a new Facebook page. Hats off to Raven and to Valerie for keeping that Facebook page up. I certainly haven't got the energy, time, or initiative to do it, and I'm glad somebody does. Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom is a group that approved this protest with some trepidation yesterday at our meeting, the protest that is trying to hold Officer Barnett and other officers who are harassing homeless people just because it's their job, and some people because they really seem to enjoy doing it. And also asks the question, what's going on with racial profiling as in Santa Cruz as well? And, you know, you can set up your own protest anytime you want. On the corner, put up a sign. I mean, I would like to see some signs against the renewed war in Iraq and Syria that Obama is dragging us into. It's amazing that all the great peace-loving folks aren't out there. A year ago, people were screaming at the top of their voices, or at least loud enough for the Congress to hear them around the Syria intervention. Now, that ain't happening. I'm going to take a sort of a pause here. Well, not really a pause. I'm going to turn to things I don't usually do, which is I accumulate a lot of newspaper articles that I'd love to talk about, but apparently don't. And I'm going to try and do this now. Just to kind of pass on to you some thoughts I have on a couple of issues. Some of them have to do with the ongoing war expansion that is happening. Some of them have to do with police misconduct. Some of them have to do with sort of local stuff. And, you know, you may have some thoughts yourself. You can call in with your reflections on some of these issues. I'm going to try to put these together into different categories so we can kind of run through categories briefly and figure, put them all pretty much in the proper order. Categories that I'm going to look at, well, the first one I'm going to look at is police misconduct nationally and statewide, and also potentially locally as well. There are a number of articles that I pulled from the Mercury News and the Sentinel, some of which you may have seen. Cops awash in military gear. Agencies in the region have received more than $14 million worth of equipment from federal programs. This is in out of San Jose, so the area is also includes our area, I would imagine. The Defense Department apparently has an acquisition program or a dispersal program called the 1033 program, which since 1995, according to the Karina Yaffe, I-O-F-F-E-E, of the Mercury News, has given more than $5 billion worth of military surplus to police agencies around the country. And apparently, although this program has been in force for two decades, information about what the police have received has... has disappeared from my as the story went into page 7, and I apparently don't have page 7. Apparently, the information has only recently gotten out, in part because of the protests in Ferguson and the vivid, not just the protests, the response to the protests by the militarized police vehicles and formations. But we've seen that in Santa Cruz too. For those of you who were around during the Occupy movement, the police agencies moved in military formation, not just to destroy homeless encampments, destroy the Occupy protest, falsely arrest five people who were trying to help the protesters, not the protesters, the homeless people who had been in the only in a homeless encampment that had been there for 2 months in San Lorenzo Park, a community that they had created and that the community had supported, with no deaths in that encampment. This is what I often point out. People are saying, oh, you know, these encampments are dirty, there's drugs, there's violence, and these things do happen there, for sure. as they happen in housed situations all over the place, although it's much more visible for people who are homeless. But in terms of actual morbidity rates, this was documented back in 1996 when the Santa Cruz police, under the direction of then-Mayor Rotkin and Vice Mayor Kennedy, no doubt with Cynthia Matthews looking on and nodding approvingly, she was on the council, they destroyed the Coral Street open-air shelter, which had housed 200 people. It was essentially a campground where people set up their own tents and kept them up during the day, protecting their possessions, their dogs, what they had. And a lot of people have been driven out of San Francisco by then-Mayor Jordan's Matrix program. After the campsite was dispersed, it was flooded, admittedly, but that wouldn't have been really the final straw. What was the final straw was Mayor Rotkin's determination to eliminate the campsite, and he did. This was at the corner of Highway 1 and Highway 9, where it is now, we now find the Page Smith Community House. And there was no Page Smith Community House then. There was a field that people were living in called the Back 40. After that it was dispersed, people did begin to die in greater numbers from overdoses, from exposure, from other problems, and that actually inspired two of the campers there, Dragon Sard Dan Hopkins and Shit Kicker Sean Alimi, as I called them, to begin an 8-month-long protest at City Hall that went on day and night. Now it's illegal to protest at City Hall at night, showing you what our Constitution has become since that period of time. And the point is that the police were in the kind of formations I saw on December 8th, 2011, not only attacked the campground and destroyed it, all these police agencies marching through, but when we went in a peaceful protest, a march to City Hall, they wouldn't let us knock on the door of the Parks and Rec Department. The police chief himself blocked me from going there. He threatened me with a citation if I crossed the street. Police bivouacked at City Hall. We have a militarization problem in Santa Cruz as well as elsewhere. If you look at what happens when there's an incident downtown, you will suddenly see 5 or 6 squad cars and masses of police, well, numbers of police, unnecessarily numerous gatherings of police officers there, either indicating that, I don't know, they got nothing better to do or that there is a new doctrine that they're following, which has to do with sort of intimidate people who, the community generally, I guess it's the old Machiavelli's Dictum from the Prince, which was a book written by an Italian character back in the, I guess it was the 16th century, which is a prince can rule either by love or by fear, but apparently fear is more effective if you can't get them to love you. So fear is what they do with the police. There is been some publicity about police getting cameras themselves to presumably make them more accountable. And I think the Santa Cruz Police Department does have some cameras attached to their vehicles. This raised issues for me some years ago, in that if the police are using these cameras to video people who are not engaging in criminal behavior and then keeping those videos, that's a form of harassment and political persecution. In fact, our current deputy police chief, Steve Clark, took out after then, well, he's now a radio broadcaster, John Malkin, and an author. He does a show on Wednesday nights, The Great Leap Forward. But at that time, he was on the Citizens Police Review Board and had been a part of the movement to create a Citizens Police Review Board, a board that was dispersed essentially through conservative and police pressure and power about 12 years ago. But way back when, Clark went after Malkin and said, I have a political file on you. And Malkin has written about this and talked about this. And that is a very dangerous aspect to the kind of information that police can get together and have. And so, and then the issue arises, can cameras that police are carrying around on their persons to document what they're doing, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, if they could truly be held accountable for what they're doing, and this is, I guess, an attempt to do that, or at least to indicate that they are trying to do that, or give the impression that they are doing that, that would be a good idea. However, is it going to work? I don't know. There's also a technology that's supposedly keeping an eye on troubled officers to identify problem officers before their misbehavior harms innocent people, embarrasses their employer, or invites a costly lawsuit, either from citizens or from the feds. This is an article in the Sentinel from September 5th off the AP wire from Tommy Abdullah. And this has been done in Los Angeles. 39% of law enforcement agencies supposedly use a computerized system to make police accountable. Is this effective? Experts, according to this writer, say the early warning system can be a powerful tool to help officers do their job and improve relations. However, if you go deeper into this article, because their objective, as they say, is to avoid cases where the first evidence of a troubled officer is a YouTube video showing the cop beating somebody up or shooting somebody, which, you know, really is the first time you hear about this stuff. So all this blather and expense of supposedly having these internal processes, it makes me wonder. Although I suppose maybe you might say that these have prevented these things from happening. But the LAPD, according to this article, that's the Los Angeles Police Department, agreed to set up a $33 million warning system against abusive officers after the so-called Rampart scandal, in which an elite anti-gang unit was found to have beaten and framed suspected gang members. And the system was implemented in 2007, according to this article. But the LAPD's inspector general found in a recent review that the system was ineffective in identifying officers who ultimately were fired. The report looked at 748 alerts over a four-month period and found the agency took action in the majority of cases and only required training for 1.3% or 10 alerts of them. 10 alerts out of 748 were what the police higher-ups watching the so-called beware of potentially abusive officers did some actually responded to. Sam Walker, University of Nebraska at Omaha, professor emeritus and expert in such systems, said he was troubled by the department's response to the report and concerned that their follow-up study would be used to discredit the system a year after the LAPD had emerged from federal oversight, which is what they were under after the Rampart scandal. These are not predictive devices, he said. Is the failure in the system itself, or is the failure in how the department managed the system? If they did such a small amount of retraining, did they ignore lots of training needs and fail to do it? And there's sort of talk back and forth about what went wrong with the LAPD monitored the officer's system. For rank-and-file officers, there's concern someone could be flagged merely because, for example, they work in a high-crime area where they're more likely to use their weapon or physical force. Some systems attempt to correct for such factors by comparing officers with their direct peers, and managers are supposed to account for differences in their assignments. Their concern is the concern that the public has about Big Brother. If you're watching over me and there's a setup matrix that's going to tell you that I'm bad, people are always skeptical about things like that. 2011 Justice Department report found the New Orleans Police Department's system, adopted roughly two decades ago, was outdated and existed only in name. Investigators and information was included haphazardly, and flagged officers were put into an essentially bad boy school, a one-size-fits-all seen by some as a badge of honor. The system is being overhauled. Now, in Santa Cruz, when an officer, the same guy who was shot dead 2 years ago, Lauren Butchie Baker, was accused credibly by nine women, actually more, but I was listening to the old council meeting, which you can find online, by the way, in the archives for this radio show on the Huff website. When in 1992, the city's own commissioner for the prevention of violence against women asked that this officer Baker, who was accused of fondling more than half a dozen women, be put on administrative duty while these matters were investigated by the city council or by some independent group. Instead, the police department transferred him, actually promoted him to detective, and declared him Officer of the Year. I know Baker personally because he's the only officer I've ever won a lawsuit against. He falsely arrested me for tabling on Pacific Avenue in 2002, 10 years after this incident, this concern that the city council first expressed some concern about and then dumped and ignored and allowed the police department to free reign, as they've done ever since. That's generally what the cities generally do with police departments until it becomes so, the stench becomes so bad there's not much you can do. I'll look at the, here's a story from San Jose. San Jose police rape, battle over late claim. Filing missed court deadline because of trauma, a woman said. The woman who prosecutors contend was raped last year by an on-duty San Jose police officer is asking the courts to waive the six-month deadline for filing a financial claim against the city and the cop by saying that she was too traumatized after being sexually assaulted to file on time and was misled by government officials about her legal rights. First, it sounds like, oh, you know, she's looking to get out. She screwed up on her deadline, you know, come on. Then you get deeper into the article, and you find that, and I think I actually do have the second page of this article, that according to her attorney, Roger Hecht, she was supposed to file a claim within 6 months of the incident, and then a lawsuit 6 months later if the claim was rejected or forfeit her chances of getting compensated at state court or even for the medical costs or loss of earnings associated with the rape. Or the alleged rape. And this is true for us, too. If you have an incident that happens with the police, you have to file within 6 months a claim against the city, or you don't get state claims anymore. It's too late. You can go to federal court, I think, within a year or 2 years, but that's more expensive. It's harder. It's often a better idea because you're more likely to get a fairer hearing rather than the local courts, which are contaminated with the cozy relationship they have with police officers. That's one of the problems we have locally. In any case, the article continues, if you want to read far enough, suing the city and the officer might jeopardize the prosecution's chances of convicting Graves was apparently one of the motivations here, whose lawyers could argue to jurors that she's just after the city's money. Graves, in other words, the prosecutors wouldn't cooperate with this victim because they wanted to, they supposedly go after the officer and not have the witness, have the defense say, oh, well, this woman who's a witness against claims that, you know, she's raped, is just trying to get money from the police department. Graves has pleaded not guilty. He's free on $100,000 bail and on paid administrative leave. Hecht suggests that the police who interviewed the purported rape victim three times and representatives of the Santa Clara County DA's office purposefully misled her. In the course of the San Jose Police Department's interrogation of her, as well as in her interactions with the DA's office, she asked whether she needed to do anything more to protect her interests. She was never told she needed to submit a federal claim, within 6 months. To the contrary, she was told to do nothing until the criminal case was concluded and then to go through them. The police department and the DA's office. The petition states that she and reps of the DA's office specifically discussed her interest in obtaining a visa. She apparently was I don't know if she's an illegal immigrant or someone who's trying to extend her visa, which can be pursued after the case resolved. In the declaration attached to the petition, the woman also says she was told she would have to wait until the case was over before she could proceed with any filing, not just the visa. So the issue here is she's just trying to file a claim, and they're not letting her file a late claim, even though, or at least not so far, because she was misled by the DA's office and by the police department of San Jose. You might say, well, and this is, of course, a good lesson for us, go get independent information. I always advise people, you know, you cannot really rely on the police department and the DA's office to give you necessarily accurate information. They have their own interests to defend, and they're often not in the same ballpark as your interests. A DA's office is looking for convictions. The police department is looking to solve crimes or at least have somebody that they can find as a plausible perp to deal with concern about a crime in the community. And I'm not saying that many police officers aren't interested in genuinely solving crimes. But the solution may involve violating people's rights, it may involve not informing people, and it also may involve buffing up the reputation of the police department, even when that is not justified, defending the reputation of the police department. Anyway, that's the case of, and I guess this, the woman is not named. I guess she's a rape victim. The officer is Jeffrey Graves, a San Jose police officer, facing sexual assault charges. I imagine her name is public, but we don't get that. I'm a civil libertarian, so I also found another interesting case. This is not about the police. This is, however, about wearing a shirt with a message on it to school and being suppressed by authorities. And before you jump on board and say, yeah, right on, Robert, these people wanted to wear American flags on their T-shirt and in a case where this is a Morgan Hill school where there was a Mexican holiday, and the school banned the flag on the T-shirt, suggesting that it would create conflict with people who were sympathetic with the Mexican holiday and felt that that was, maybe felt the United States had, invaded Mexico and taken over half its territory. I don't know where they got that idea. But that there might be some bad will and it'll produce some conflict in the school and that the authorities had the right to stop that. I think that's ridiculous. I think that that's the first step on the road to, that's a form of censorship that is repugnant to me and I think repugnant to a democratic society or a free society. And I don't care if we're talking, I suppose if somebody has a shirt that says die nigger die on it and comes to a rally and at a school, that might be different because it's, I'd have to think further about that as well. I mean, in this might be considered hate speech. It is hate speech, obviously, or die kikes die, or, homeless trolls, gas them. That kind of stuff. I still regard that as free speech because what it really shows me is the mentality of the people who are coming forward. And the main problems that oppressed minorities face is not from explicit repression. And homeless people are one of the biggest minorities, or one of the smallest minorities, or one of the who face the biggest oppression, is that they are not directly oppressed. Quite contrary, the people who are oppressing them are claiming that they're after protecting their own safety, and they're putting in a security gate out at the homeless lack of services center, and they're putting in IDs to protect those homeless people and to make sure they're okay, and also to protect the community from the bad homeless people, the ones who are, the questionable, the people who go out and stab the head of the camouflage restaurant, the ones who would, although they weren't homeless, the guy wasn't homeless, who had shot Butchie Baker and Elizabeth Butler, all the bad homeless people who are spewing needles all over the community. That's the mythology that we get to hear. And the people who are protecting the homeless community will essentially ignore the most obvious things, like the sleeping ban, the sitting ban, criminalization of people. I recently was told by Dr. Mike here, who's in the studio, that bicycle lockers have been not merely been made verboten to put non-bicycle materials in, which homeless people, and others used to do too, but now they are transparent so that people can, these authorities can snoop into your locker and see what you've got in there. And it kind of reminds me about the bathrooms. You look at the bathrooms in the garages, the parking garages, at least the one down on Walnut Street. No, Locust Street. You now get to see the person's feet as you look in the stall. You can't see their butt, and you can't see their genitalia, but, you know, it's an attempt to suggest that these are people who are... anybody use these bathrooms as a potential criminal, and we have to keep an eye on them. On the other hand, right around the corner is the restaurant bathroom and the employee bathroom, which has a door you can lock. And it has a nice stall, a private stall you can go into. Actually, I think the stall is just part of the room where you lock the door. So we have this sort of two-tier system. It used to be all the rage in South Africa and all the rage back in the segregationist days in the South. And now it has to do with if you're poor or if you're aspiring not to be poor and can pretend that you're doing okay and don't have to be... considered a financial risk or a risk of becoming a burden to the community in the sense of you'll be visible poverty as a burden to the community. Anyway, this case involves the Morgan Hill flag T-shirt. There was a ruling by a court that found that the South Bay High School had the legal right to order students wearing American flag-adorned shirts to turn them inside out during a 2010 Cinco de Mayo celebration. Bullshit. And I don't think that's just my white privilege showing here. I think that that's a matter of principle for me. Ninth U.S. Circuit of Appeals, however, upheld this decision, which accepted the authority of school authorities to... decide what kind of shirt you can wear, what kind of insignia you can have, even at a political protest. And that ain't good. Lawyers for the parents, backed by 20 Republican members of Congress, had asked the Ninth Circuit to hear the case. Three Ninth Circuit judges dissented, saying they disagreed with both the court's ruling in the case and its decision not to grant a new hearing. The three-judge panel had originally found that, given the safety concerns, the school's actions were reasonable. The parents have told this newspaper the students were only showing their patriotism, did not intend to incite trouble with Latino students on Cinco de Mayo. Well, maybe it would incite a debate. Wouldn't that be a good thing, to incite a debate? To have the kind of, you know... Hey, you immigrants, you go back where you came from. No, we have a right to be here. You're all a bunch of bums. No, actually, we do the work that you guys won't do. I mean, to have that kind of discussion and debate between people who are young and people who are older, I think is a positive thing. And I dissent from, I joined the Republicans in this one. What's happening in Ferguson, Missouri? It doesn't get too much play, but they are still allowing this phony grand jury non-investigation to go forward with the same DA who is police biased, or that seems to be what the concern is, to proceed. And people are last tried to block a freeway, and masses of them were arrested for doing that as a protest, peacefully block a freeway, mind you. Walk out and engage in civil disobedience. But you don't get that much anymore. And, you know, the newspapers are waiting for riots. They apparently need riots for folks or huge numbers of people to show up. Unless, of course, it's Obama making a pro-war speech, in which case they're all over it like flies on shit. It's depressing. Again, critics have called for Prosecutor Bob McCullough, back in Ferguson, Missouri, to either step aside or for Governor Jay Nixon to appoint a special prosecutor, citing concerns about whether McCullough could fairly oversee the case. McCullough's father was a police officer killed in the line of duty by a black assailant in the 1960s. Last Tuesday, or maybe it was the Tuesday before last, protesters seeking the immediate arrest of the Ferguson police officer, Wilson, who fatally shot an unarmed 18-year-old and then left his body rotting in the street for 4 hours, disrupted a government meeting on Tuesday, renewing calls to remove the county prosecutor investigating the case. The demand for Darren Wilson's arrest and the recusal of the St. Louis County prosecuting attorney began with the final utterance of the Pledge of Allegiance at the St. Louis County Council meeting. For all, crowd members shouted as the pledge concluded with, and justice for all. My usual response to the Pledge of Allegiance, which begins every meeting of the Board of Supervisors and the City Council, while everybody else stands up and puts their hands on their heart, is to remain seated and then to shout, when is that going to happen? Or horse shit. I don't usually use that phrase. I usually say something else. And I don't usually say anything, actually, but I have, because this is this kind of ritual, this kind of mechanized fantasy that we are in a land where justice prevails is unhealthy. If you really are interested in justice, you know, it's a sad thing. And people respond to it. So, for instance, here is a story. Man sought an ambush shooting of two troopers. Blooming Grove, Pennsylvania, one dead, another wounded in deadly vendetta versus police. Hundreds of law enforcement officers fanned out across the dense northeastern Pennsylvania woods. This is from yesterday's paper. Yesterday's, I think it's Mercury News, might be Sentinel. In the hunt for a heavily armed survivalist suspected of ambushing two troopers as part of a deadly vendetta. Eric Matthew Friend, 31, of Canadensis, is extremely dangerous, quote-unquote. According to the police commissioner, Frank Noonan. He's made statements about wanting to kill law enforcement officers, committed mass acts of murder. He has very strong feelings about law enforcement. He was charged with first-degree murder. We have no idea where he is. 200 law enforcement officials were combing the rural areas. A U.S. Army manual called Sniper Training and Employment was found in the suspect's bedroom. His father, a retired Army major, told authorities his son is an excellent marksman who doesn't miss. And then it says, the gunman killed Corporal Brian Dixon, 38, and critically wounded Trooper Alex Douglas outside the barracks during a Friday night shift change, then slipped away. It doesn't state how they know it was him. But let's assume maybe, although the problem is, again, in these stories, it doesn't say so-and-so said, or such-and-such saw, or there was a camera that noticed. Maybe, you know, they're making statements that could be considered libelous if, you know, if it wasn't him. So let's assume maybe they know what they're talking about. They zeroed in after Frayne after a resident was walking his dog in a wooded area, spotted a 2001 Jeep partly submerged in a pond, and called 911. Ah, here's the evidence. Police found shell casings inside the Jeep matching those found at the shooting scene, which isn't conclusive, but, you know, it's evidence. Investigators also found Frayne's driver's license, social security card, Pennsylvania Game Commission range permit, camouflage face paint, a black hooded sweatshirt. Boy, we get a lot of details here. Two empty rifle cases, military gear, and information about foreign embassies, according to court documents. One begins to wonder if all this evidence is so carefully outlined. Often after the police kill someone, one discovers the very bad record that that person had and what an awful person he was. And, you know, the police suddenly release all this information. They did that in Ferguson with the Michael Brown case. They tried to link him to, and perhaps did link him to, it's not clear, a robbery of some cigars from a 7-Eleven type store. And they did this on the same day that they finally, after refusing for 4 or 5 days to release the name of Darren Wilson, the man who murdered Michael Brown. I consider it to be murder. I know he hasn't been tried. I know he's still on duty, or if he's maybe his paid administrative leave. But my impression, from what I know, is it was a murder. And I don't mind saying that. I guess they won't put me on the jury, but, you know. I mean, I could be persuaded otherwise if I saw new evidence, but I haven't seen that. My point is that some people respond with violence to... It's not mentioned here what his grievance with the police department is. Maybe it's crazy. You know, he's the lone assassin. He's a crazy guy. Or maybe not. Maybe there's a whole series of abuses that happened which predated all this. Maybe not. I mean, or maybe he had a personal dispute with these officers. I don't know what the story is. But that's kind of my take on some of the police stuff that I ran across in the newspaper. I've got some stuff here. And by the way, caller, I caught you rang once. Call again, and I'll certainly put you on the air if you're listening to this broadcast. I'm not going to ignore you, but I wanted to finish what I was reading. Let's see what we've got here. I think we're going to get into... Yes. These are interviews last Saturday. Gosh, was it? Seems like a lot longer ago, but I think it was last Saturday in People's Park. And actually, these are right around the corner from People's Park. People's Park is a park established by the community, forcefully established. The community tore down a fence that the University of California had put up, occupied the area, planted flowers, created paths, planted trees, and began using it as a community resource. I think we attempted to do something like that in Santa Cruz for a while at different places, and the police have driven us away at different times. Most recently, I think it was in the Beach Flats. But the Mediterranean Cafe is a cafe around the corner from People's Park on Telegraph Avenue, four blocks from the large University of California at Berkeley, on the south side of Berkeley, called South Side because it's on the south side of the University of California. The Med is a place I've been in scores of times. Not so much recently because I haven't lived in Berkeley for some time, but I used to live up there. And a number of us who had been at this fight back against corporate power, against police harassment of homeless people and poor people, immigrants, workers, tenants, after this People's Park rally and series of speeches, we all sat down and had a cup of tea, and here's some of the conversation and interviews that ensued.
So here we are in the Med. It's about 5:30. The proposed march and sit-in in the Med looks to have petered out, but I'm talking with...
Dimitri.
Dimitri, you are a local at Berkeley. You look like you got your sleeping bag with you, so I assume you're sleeping out tonight.
Yes, I am.
And you're a man who's been Berkeley for quite a while.
Yeah, since the mid-70s.
And if we look at the windows here, we see a couple of them broken. What do you make of it?
I know that's happened recently. I'm not sure how or why I have my suspicions. But actually, it was just one a few days ago. And as I came in today, I noticed there's another. So
I think that actually they were both broken at the same time. That's what Michael tells me. But...
No.
So, as a man who sleeps out regularly, you have a very close perspective on how police are treating folks, at least some of the folks outside.
I do.
Now, any reports on how that's going?
I've been coming here to Berkeley back and forth for the last few months since I came back to Berkeley, because I lived in Berkeley earlier, but then I moved away. And it seems very much like a police state. Between the police and the security, driving around and just watching people all the time, it's kind of eerie. It's kind of creepy. You know, and it's pretty quiet here. You know, the people in the park, they move elsewhere at night. They move across the street, or they move, you know, where they can to sleep. I don't see a lot of problems. It's the same stuff they've always done, you know. Every once in a while there's a flare-up, but it's self-contained. But they make much to do about nothing, the police.
And they have to engage in some kind of activity to earn their salary?
Yeah, they have to justify their existence, I've noticed that too. You know, they come into the park early in the morning. There's one guy in particular, I don't know his name, I guess he's a sergeant or something, and he's a real jerk. And he comes into the park early in the morning and he kind of throws his weight around.
Now, are people still sleeping there in spite of the, I guess there's either an ordinance or a policy that prohibits sleeping in the park at night?
Yeah. And there's some time it was enforcing it, you know. I mean, one time I was sleeping there and they came over and four guys standing over me with flashlights, four police standing over me with flashlights, and made me move. move. And now my friends sleep over there, and they sleep back away from the main field. So they sleep, you know, where the playground is and further back.
So they are illegal sleepers in the park.
Well, they're sleepers, in my opinion. But yeah, they don't bother anyone. They just, you know, try to get a good night's sleep. And sometimes they kick them out, sometimes they don't.
So it varies.
They've been leaving them alone.
And how many folks would you estimate sleep in the park every night?
I'd say a good 60 or more. Yeah, oh yeah.
And so generally, sometimes they roust all 60, sometimes they don't roust any?
Yeah, sometimes they just go through and do a sweep. Sometimes they go through and do a sweep and make everybody leave. But like I said, I haven't seen that this time around.
And does the sweep involve citations or just move along?
When the one time I saw them do it, it was, you know, because everyone was cooperative. Everyone did what they asked. You know, everyone got up and left. Nobody was happy because, you know, who likes to be woken up at night with a bright light in their face in the middle of the night? But, you know, people understand.
Other parks also verboten at night?
I think so. I know sometimes I go down to Willard, and there's a restroom that's open all night.
Restroom's open, but the park isn't?
I don't know if the park is open or not. I would assume it's not because I don't see a lot of people there. And that's kind of raccoon park. So,
a lot of raccoons?
Yeah, big raccoons. I like them, but a lot of people don't. And they're not shy. They'll come right up to you.
Have you been bitten yet by any of these raccoons?
No, but I fed them. I fed one of them.
Oh, really? Yeah. Have you been able to identify any by name?
Not yet. Not yet.
The honey?
Maybe soon, but not yet.
Anything? You heard the presentations today, and you gave me a positive review. What was your general feeling about the whole show?
I was impressed with the history of the speakers. I was impressed with the knowledge. I was impressed with the forthrightness, especially the one guy who just said straight up, "Don't trust the police." You know, and
Russell Bates.
I totally agree with Russell. I totally, you know, and I like the fact he didn't bite his tongue. He said, you know, look, and he, one thing he said is that, you know, they ride around with serve and protect on their cars. You know, I wanted to shout out, they took it off. They don't have that on the cars anymore. They took off the serve and protect.
They're trying honesty and advertising.
Yeah, they're not even pretending anymore. You know?
But you don't have to. This is a national security crisis.
Yeah.
You people are causing trouble.
Yeah. So says them. But yeah, they're making it obvious who they serve, and they're not shy about making it obvious who they serve. You know, they're not serving the poor. They're not here to help the poor at all. They're here to harass the poor.
How long have you yourself been outside?
Off and on for about 10 years. You know.
Any changes in the last decade?
Oh, a lot. Like I said, it's becoming more of a police state. You know, it used to be a time where the police would kind of like, there was a tolerance thing. You know, we don't really want you guys here, but we understand that, you know, that you need to be somewhere. But now it's gotten really, you know, kind of, you know, you don't have anyone to back you up, so we can do whatever we want with you. And it's gotten, not all of them, but a lot of them have gotten to the point where they do incredibly illegal stuff. Like my friend said the other day, you know, yesterday, they came up and went through everyone's pockets. One of the cops said, "I smell weed," so he went through everybody's pockets that were there. And I asked my friend, "Why'd you let them?" That's illegal. They can't just search you, you know. And I said, that makes it hard on all of us when one of us lets them do that. But those are the kind of things they're doing now where they don't even try to abide by the law. You know, if they feel like searching people, they're going to assume that there'll be no repercussions, and they'll do it. So, you know, any man that lets another man go through his pockets,
you mean he wants a special kind of really close search?
Yeah, I mean, I don't care what they're wearing or what badge they have on. No one has the right to put their hand in your pocket, you know. I mean, unless you are under arrest and you're being, you know, booked down at the station, then it's a different thing.
Any other changes in the last 10 years?
I'd see a lot of changes in emergence. You know, I see kind of a coldness in emergence. I see a kind of a, you know, you notice the no public restroom signs all over the place. You know, it used to be like this place, you can walk in and use the restroom. You can go across the street to Moe's and walk in and use the restroom. And these are two very rare things. So
is that still the case here?
Yeah, you can still go up. I just came for the restroom.
Even if you have a sleeping bag, you didn't buy anything.
I walk in here all the time and get water. And, you know, they've seen me. You know, a lot of times I'll even try to make a, you know, I'll try to clean up around the water area, do something, you know, to justify me being here. But this place, you know, a lot of times, you know, they, depending on who's working here, they're very tolerant. A lot of times these guys are pretty cool, depending on who's working here. But I come to use the restroom all the time. I rarely ever buy anything. I go to Moe's and I'll stand Moe's and read a whole book. And they know it. And,
any good books lately?
Yeah, a lot of good books. A lot of good books.
Anything you want to conclude with? Anything else?
I like the rally, and I hope you guys do a lot more of that in the park.
We've been talking with
Dimitri Clark.
Thank you, Dimitri.
I think the draw is people here. That doesn't take people away. The people outside playing music, in my opinion, that draws people here.
What draws people? Oh, the music on the streets.
Yeah.
Because
same thing with the
poster. Michael, we're here in the Med, and I see two of the windows are broken. They were broken a month ago when I was here talking with you before.
Started the fight back.
You're concerned. Give us a little history of why those windows were broken. And
so the way I understand it.
This is Michael Delacour, who actually was the person who initiated this whole rally in the park. He's a long-time activist in the 70s and a union organizer. He's called into the show a couple times. I've interviewed him. And here's his discussion of his an interesting relationship with the people in the Med. He knows the owner, a guy called Craig. And so does one of our Huff members. Actually, one at the meeting apparently also knows the owner of the... It's called the Mediterranean Cafe. That's distinguished from the Mediterranean Cafe. And Craig is, well, you're going to hear Michael Delacour talk about this issue. There were two windows that were broken. They were broken, not completely broken out, but they're cracked and look like it could, you know, be pressed through. And they're look like a car wreck at the cafe almost. And that was the case like 3 or 4 weeks ago when I was up there too. And so they haven't been repaired, and that seemed to be interesting. Why wouldn't they repair them? Michael talks about this.
There was the McCarran Park deadhead thing, you know, where thousands of people showed up at the deadhead concert. What was that, about a month ago? So then they moved to Haight. And that night they spent the night at Haight, a group of people. And then the next night they came over here. And so they had a party out here all night. And then the police came in at 9 o'clock. Actually, Ted probably even knows more of the details, and raided them. And then, so then one of the guys that was out there that got raided, he came in here, and, you know, he was whatever, he got a little upset. They tried to kick him out, and that's how the windows got broken. Then he, in
turn, there
are
two windows, one on the door and one near the door that smashed.
Went outside to the police car, and they handcuffed him, and then he busted out the back end of the window. I mean, he really busted it out.
What was his fate? Where is he now?
I don't know.
Okay.
Michael is talking about the back end of the police car windows.
And you called at the park to have a sit-in protest here in this place, and I pointed out to you, and you were saying to me, Dimitri, that this is a place that does, along with Moe's, allow you to hang out.
Only two I can think of on this block that actually...
Restroom. I mean, aren't there other places that are also equally... You said, Michael, that the owner here, although he is a personal friend of yours and comes to your birthday party, he's also the leader of the Sit Law Initiative
and president of the
TBIT,
which is the Telegraph Avenue Business Improvement District. And so it's a group of people that work for the landlords, basically. The landlords put money into that, and they're the ones that shut down the street here every Sunday during the summer for the last 3 or 4 years, right? They basically have co-opted what we used to do at People's Park, you know, have a lot of concerts, and now they have them on Telegraph Avenue, but for business reasons, to create more business.
And does this also serve anybody who wants to come, including people who are outside?
Yes. My objection is that it's very repressive. donated through their ambassador program, which are these pink, orange meanies, as I call them.
We have yellow jackets in Santa Cruz called the hosts.
All right.
They're the eyes and ears, the snitches for the police.
You got it. Me too. Yeah. Thanks. I mean, thanks, Robert. You're way ahead.
Well, unfortunately, we're similar.
So, anyway, the big thing they do is they eliminated the communication process that for the people that are alumni or people that used to go to school or hang out here.
Kiosks, you were mentioning that.
Find out what's happening with our notices and the books and the kiosks. They've eliminated the three kiosks that we won after People's Park. They agreed to put in three and they put in these.
Was there actually a formal agreement to that effect?
Yeah.
When was
the bathroom?
What year was that?
It was 69. That was after the agreement on the struggle.
The bathroom put in a 91 or 92, 93?
I'm speaking of the bathroom that's in the parking lot.
Parking lot.
That was the first bathroom we got up here for ourselves.
Which parking lot is that?
The parking lot that's on Channing and a little bit on that side of Telegraph.
Yeah, I got you. So in spite of the fact that this has been, in its practical day-to-day policies, it seems to be more liberal here at the Med for folks who are outside or poor. Nonetheless, as a political force, you feel this is a good target for demonstrating because of the political views and activities of the owner.
He thinks he owns the sidewalk, where it's all of our sidewalk. It's just not him and his business. Like, for example, if somebody puts stuff out here in front, he'll drive them off. He thinks that that's his area. So, in the same thing, he wants to expand in front of his store here all the way down the street and drive these young people.
In Santa Cruz, those areas have been privatized. That is to say, they now lease from the city large segments of the sidewalk, and the area in front of it that is not leased, it's illegal to put up a table, sit down, play music from a seated position.
So that's where we're going here, I guess.
It's the wave of the future.
So then how do you struggle against that? We can have a riot, go down the street and bust out windows. You got it. Or what I'm suggesting is that we come in here and take all these seats. And then then I'll have to say you have to leave. So that will be the confrontation. So I'd love it.
You have actually 8 people sitting around a table.
We bought coffee.
You have been patronizing this individual's place.
See, that's what
you're funding his reactionary agenda.
Yes. Well, don't we all in this society?
Indeed. We've been talking with
Michael Delacour.
Thank you, Michael.
But we are.
We're talking with
Ted Friedman, BerkeleyReporter.com.
And Tip, you've been here for how long?
Ted?
Yes.
40 years. And I've been in Santa Cruz a fair amount years ago.
So in Berkeley, you say there was a crackdown 25 years ago?
In Santa Cruz, I remember the first restrictions.
No, the 1994 ordinances.
Before that, they were on it early. They were on it in the 80s. You could do more than you can probably do now in that you could play music, but you couldn't approach anyone for money or step out in their path or anything like that. So they were watching it.
Okay. What kind of a change have you seen in Berkeley?
I, as a reporter, and I've covered it for the Berkeley Daily Planet as well, I couldn't find any signs that police were abusing anybody or asking people to move. On the other hand, they did mysteriously clear out people from downtown when things got to be unsightly. And there was a lot of baggage down there and so on. And sure enough, and this was in the lead up to that no-sit measure that was on the ballot.
Last year, or 2 years ago.
Yeah, sure. sure enough, they disappeared. And I checked around with police and so on to try to find a smoking gun, but there was nothing there. There was no proof that there were probably some badass officers downtown who may have made people move. I suspect that, but I don't know it.
Well, I've gotten a lot of counts in Santa Cruz of people who have been harassed, ticketed. And again, the laws are such that it's easy to criminalize people there now.
Santa Cruz has a particular issue in that it's a resort community. It's the university is well off from the downtown. It always was a sort of a surfing town. And then you've got the amusement park and so on. And they feel that they have to protect all that. I'm sure that's what's involved. And the stakes went up after the earthquake because the businesses became more dear, more protected. That's my view.
Yeah, interesting view. And so again, Ted, to read your stuff, people should go to
BerkeleyReporter.com.
And I may do just that.
Well, I'd appreciate it, and it's been great meeting you and hearing you today.
Thank you, Ted. Same.
And that was Berkeley last Saturday, kind of in the aftermath of People's Park. I have more tape, and indeed you're still tuned to Free Radio, the stream of Free Radio anyway. This is a rather bad recording of some of the oral communication that happened at the last city council meeting in Santa Cruz. Now, you may recall that I've been persistently trying and failing to be able to get the police and the mayor to leave alone my tiny little defenseless tape recorder as it sits on the railing near the dais, hoping to be allowed to record. And unless I'm there or have assigned someone to sit next to it, Sergeant Bush comes and removes it. So that can interfere with things. It also interferes with things when I have to sit near the tape recorder because it makes noise when I'm kind of shuffling around there. So it's kind of an additional problem. I've sent a letter to the city council, which I'm going to be. Maybe I'll read it. I promised to read the story of yesterday's protest against Officer Barnett and other officers harassing homeless people in Santa Cruz and didn't. But then you can read that online, those of you who are online listening, at indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz Indie Media. But you can't really yet read this letter because I haven't yet printed it. So maybe I will simply give you the thrill of hearing this letter, assuming I can dredge it up. Maybe a little hard because I'm having trouble going online, but I may have a copy of it, and I think I do, and we'll try to do that here and now. You are tuned, of course, to Free Radio Santa Cruz's stream, and I'm Robert Norris, and these shows are archived in case you want to go check them out on the Huff website, huffsantacruz.org. And let's see if I can find the latest edition of this damn letter. Here we go. Yeah, all right. Well, this is the letter that was sent to Mayor Lynn Robinson and the City Council by Herman Kalfin, who is an attorney in San Francisco, and also a man who's been in, who's lived in Santa Cruz. Actually, that's where I ran into him again. And let's see if I can dredge it up. Well, I thought it was right here, but I'm having a little trouble finding it. Here it is. Dear Mayor Robinson, it is my understanding of Mr. Robert Norris is a reporter for Free Radio Santa Cruz, a writer and commentator on local matters, and frequently attends Santa Cruz City Council meetings. He has regularly recorded such meetings with a handheld device that he places near the speaker's podium, but not in such a position as to interfere with the speakers or disturb the orderly flow of council business. I understand that this is one of the few, if not only, spots in the room where an audible recording can be made with such a device. I understand he has done this with some regularity for the last several decades in order to report on issues around homelessness, police misconduct, and other matters of particular concern to the poor and working class community. I understand that you have recently enforced a city council rule which states no audio-visual recording devices may be left unattended at the speaker's lectern or elsewhere in the council chambers. I further understand that this rule has never been applied to him or other media until April 1st, 2014, when his machine was forcibly removed by an armed officer and he himself arrested when he refused to leave the room after replacing it. I understand that though this caused no disruption to council business at the April 1st meeting, the mayor chose to stop the meeting herself, threaten Mr. Norris with arrest, and then have him arrested while he asserted his Brown Act right as citizen and media person to make an audio recording of the meeting as he had regularly done before. I understand that in December of 2013, the city clerk administrator, on instructions from the mayor, advised Mr. Norris in person and by email that he would not be allowed to record there, but would have to do so from the audience or by standing up throughout the meeting and manually holding the tape recorder up to one of the loudspeakers posted 7 feet above the floor. I understand it was his belief that having to stand and hold the recording device above his head for a period of several minutes, much less several hours, the average time of a council meeting, would burden any 67-year-old reporter or someone of any age. I understand he advised you of this concern by letter, to which you had no response. I understand he was further advised he must stand or sit next to the small pocket-sized recorder throughout the meeting wherever the machine was placed, or must appoint someone to do so. Such a procedure, he said, would unduly, irrationally, and singularly burden him or any reporter. It would, he told you, not allow him for an audible recording, prohibit him from leaving the machine to consult agenda material, prevent him from interviewing people outside, and otherwise block the usual activity allowed other members of the public, not to mention the media. I understand that in response, when Mr. Norris continued to record meetings in January through March, in spite of the unattended rule, he was not molested or interfered with. I understand that in March, Mr. Norris sent an email to the mayor requesting... Having a little trouble here with this machine here. Just a second. I'm working on it. To the mayor requesting... let's see if I can... That she publicly clarify that not just he but others would be allowed to record in the traditional fashion he has done, so as not to intimidate such behavior on the part of others, nor make a special case again, we have computer difficulties, but I'm not giving up yet. Don't go away. Maybe we should go away. It looks like... Ah, I see what the problem is. The problem is... here we go. I apologize for the delay here. I think we're getting closer to managing it. I understand at the next council meeting on April 1st, several days after this email, Mr. Norris was arrested, as noted above, for replacing his audio device in the usual spot. I understand this appeared to him and others in retaliation for seeking to clarify this policy to the benefit of the general public, other reporters, and critics of the city council wishing to make their own recording of the council meetings without fear of harassment or arrest for, quote, unattended recording device. I understand that Mr. Norris is a frequent public critic of city council actions, particularly as they pertain to harsh punitive policies against homeless, disabled people. I understand that April 1st arrest deterred Mr. Norris from returning to city council meetings for several months because of the unconstitutional prohibition, on his recording from an audible point with equipment that he has in a non-disruptive manner. I understand he advised you of this fact. I understand that he requested in both a Brown Act complaint shortly after the April 1st false arrest. Anyway, this letter goes on and on, but it is actually being taken up on the city council agenda in closed session next Tuesday. So it's possible they may change their perspective or simply continue. What they did was they sent back a letter to Mr. Kalfin, the attorney, telling him that, in essence, they're going to continue their policies of excluding, not allowing the recording of a council meeting by a machine sitting without a protector next to it. I'm not sure. They think the machine is going to be assaulted. They're afraid the machine is going to blow up. They're afraid someone's going to knock it over. Or rather, they don't like the fact that I do the recording in this way from this position, and they had to cook up some kind of a rather convoluted basis, which actually I think was how this law was originally created way back in 2001 by then Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice, who didn't like the fact that we were publicizing his refusal to open shelter for homeless people in the winter, suspend the sleeping ban, as he had in fact seemingly committed himself to do during his election campaign of 1998, the year before. Anyway, I will be putting this letter up, I hope, on Santa Cruz Indie Media. It sounds a bit repetitious, but actually the attorney is covering all the details of what happened in each of the occasions when I went back to city council with a tape recorder and they were confiscated by the police. You never can tell when a tape recorder is going to, even a tape recorder can be a dangerous weapon, I guess. And in fact, actually, I've told people, if a police officer begins to talk bad to you, pull out a tape recorder. Or if you're a 21st century person, an audio device or a smartphone that will be recording what's going on. Let's see. I have some tape from that city council meeting. I'm going to play something I don't usually play too much of. Here is a man speaking, and it's a little hard to hear him, who is hostile to what I'm doing with my tape recorder. I was sitting next to it, kind of crouched down next to it, in order to attend it during the oral communications period, where Huff also had a small protest going on there, and we were concerned about supporting Paula of Paula's Cottage. She's the woman who's being essentially evicted from her family's property because where she's living does not meet the accessory dwelling unit requirements. Here's a little of this guy's speech, and it's interesting. It's, well, judge for yourself.
Okay, it's a problem. City council is funded by the taxpayers. Why? Because we need them to do the people's work. We need them to figure out why a roundabout is or is not a good idea. They need to take public input, figure out budgeting, economic impact, all of that, because I can't. You can't. We have kids, school, work, recitals, life. So we depend on these folks to do the people's work. So I ask you, please stop wasting their time, our time. A good example of this happened at the last city council meeting. These folks are up here trying to make some important decisions, and we have the esteemed gentleman to my right with his recorder playing footsie with Santa Cruz PD. Please stop the insanity. We have real problems to solve, which brings me to my second point. We all know about the incident with the toddler finding a needle on Cal a short time ago, and all we know about the recent needle sticks, some in the media and some not. But I'm not here to talk about that. I'm here to talk about what we're going to do now. We need solutions for the less fortunate among us, the addicts, the homeless, mentally ill. But we need solutions that don't put the greater population, our families, and our children at risk. I cannot take my kids to the park. I cannot take my kids to the beach. What exactly are we fighting for if it's not for the safety of our community? Nuclear engineers will tell you that any system has inherent risk, a positive non-zero value. Go ask a proponent of the needle exchange how much risk to innocent people is introduced by the needle exchange. And they will tell you, none or prove that risk exists. The reason is simple. If you admit that there's risk, then you must argue how much risk is acceptable. How many children, how many adults can be set by yield to be an acceptable risk-reward, and no one wants to be on that side of the argument, and for good reason. If anybody here on the Board of Supervisors or any other elected position above this, in this county cannot stand behind the safety of our families and children above charity services that enable the drug dealership population, I request 10 more seconds. Thank you. Then I have a message to deliver. We are here, and you have our attention. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's, I think, your standard, although I didn't ask his affiliation, Take Back Santa Cruz perspective. Essentially, he throws out a caveat, oh, we've got to find something to do, but in the meantime, let's protect our kids and our children, and the safety of the community is at stake because of discarded needles, which he blames on the needle exchange. But in fact, he might want to look at the fact that the Public Records Act, which I have not yet carefully examined, but got back actually today, talks about the diminution of Sharps containers after the cutting of funding back in 2010. Sharps containers are containers that where you can safely discard used needles. I've talked this issue to death. I think it's clear. The evidence is really clear that needle exchange is a positive benefit for the community, not just people who are addicted or needle users, but the general public. But there is a group of people concerned with eliminating a class of people from this area, and they are intent on passing laws against loitering. They would like to set up anti-mosquito, treating homeless people as mosquitoes under bridges. They would like to see camping laws rigidly enforced. They want to see parks closed and patrolled at night with more security, I should say more thuggery in the form of uniformed guards. They are interested in a different kind of society than I'm interested in here in Santa Cruz and that I hope you're interested in. Let's hear more from the Santa Cruz City Council meeting. This is the council meeting of Tuesday before last. There's another one coming up next Tuesday. I tried to find it on the agenda. What the agenda was. I sent an email to Bren Lehr. It wasn't online as of 4 o'clock this afternoon, so I may be able to tell you what's happening on Sunday. There is on Sunday also a People's Climate Mobilization meet at 11 a.m., Town Clock Park Mission, downtown Santa Cruz. And for more information, you go online, and there's, a scalpel. Sherry Connable is sending it out. It may be also on Santa Cruz Indie Media. I didn't see it there earlier, but that's something you might be interested in checking into. I will be busy at my show. Let's see what else is happening here. It doesn't seem to be. No. Meatless Monday on Sunday is mentioned at the street party at the for Animal Liberation 4 to 7, and that's going to be at the Resource Center. You can try out a bunch of different dishes, find out which, like, I think that Keith McHenry may be involved in Food Not Bombs. And, of course, on Saturday morning, there is the Warming Center out of the Circles Church. I wish I had more information for you on the progress of the attempt of bigots out there to drive away homeless vehicles by setting up permit parking around the Circles Church. I don't think they've gotten much further. When we investigated some of us at the city to look at what they've been doing, the petition that they gave supposedly had 33 of the 40 names of the people living in the area, but it was a pretty strange-looking petition. That is to say, it didn't really say what they wanted. It was a list of scrawls in many cases. And there are claims by at least one of our hawk-eyed observers here that are, she may be a little apprehensive, that these are not the actual, that someone is creating signatures that aren't really truly representative of that area. I don't know if that's true or not, but there were some protests made in response to that, calls back to the public works saying, we don't want to have permit parking in the area, at least not around the Circle Church. It's not in front of our houses. Our houses are fine. We're not having a problem. In fact, permit parking may drive people to park in front of people's houses. I actually haven't been out there. I don't know that there is permit parking out there at all at the present time. And according to Dr. Mike here, there isn't.
The only place in the whole area that they're looking for permit parking, all the other streets are looking.
And Mike tells me that that's the only place in the area that they are doing that. And I want to apologize to activist Becky Johnson, who's been listening to the show and encouraging me to look in at Twitter to check out questions. I'm doing it for the last 4 minutes of the show, but I don't think I... Of course, again, I have to probably get more training on Twitter. I'm rather thick-headed or a slow learner on the whole thing. And let's see what else we got here. There is an updated Free Radio Santa Cruz schedule for those of you who want to hear or read what the latest program panorama is. Just go to freakradio.org and check that out. And I am actually in consultation with the First Amendment Coalition, which is a group up in San Francisco that concerns itself with public meetings and public spaces. And I've been corresponding with Terry Frank and Peter Scheer about the city council's crackdown on my audio recording and also on some other issues as well. So I think that's just about it. The assistant city administrator, Christina Santana, has emailed me back that she's finalizing the agenda and will be posted, may even be posted now. So for you folks who are interested in actually looking at the agenda of the city council online, you'll be able to do that soon. Not that it's necessarily worth a lot of your time, mind you, but it should be there for sure, because that what they do impacts you. I can tell you that right now.